The headlines: Iran's president strongly condemns an attack on Azerbaijan's embassy in Tehran and orders thorough investigation into the deadly incident. Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters across the occupied West Bank a day after killing 10 of their compatriots. Also, Moscow calls the new U.S. sanctions against Russia over the Ukraine war absurd, saying foreign companies are the first to suffer. Welcome, everybody. It's World News. Our top story for this half hour: the Iranian president has ordered an all-out investigation into the deadly shooting at the Azeri embassy in Tehran. Ibrahim Raisi condemned the attack and extended condolences to the people and government of Azerbaijan. The Iranian foreign minister was also on the phone with his Azeri counterpart. Hossein Amir Abdullahian warned of enemy plots to take advantage of the incident. He said Tehran and Baku shouldn't allow the incident to adversely impact the relations between the two countries. Amir Abdullahian also proposed that the two countries' security bodies jointly look into the incident. The Azeri foreign minister welcomed the proposal. Earlier on Friday, a gunman shot dead a diplomat and wounded two other embassy staff after storming the building. He was arrested shortly after the attack. Initial investigations point to a personal motive. The attacker claims that his Azeri wife entered the embassy months ago and never returned. Azerbaijan says it will now evacuate its embassy. Iranians across the country have held rallies condemning the desecration of the holy war on in Europe. People took to the streets in the capital, Tehran, and other cities following Friday prayers. They said the heinous acts are meant to provoke and inflame the sentiments of more than 2 billion Muslims worldwide. The protesters called on European authorities to put an end to hostilities against Islam. The desecration of Islam's holy book also triggered protests in Afghanistan. People marched in the capital, Kabul, and other major cities across Afghanistan. Bahrain also saw similar protests. Protesters gathered in the capital, Manama, despite heightened security measures. On Sunday, a Dutch politician tore up a copy of the Quran in the city of Hague. It followed the move by a politician in Sweden to burn a copy of the Holy Book outside the Turkish embassy. Many Muslim governments, including Iran, Pakistan, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates, have slammed the acts of sacrilege. Earlier, we were joined by activist and political analyst Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi. He says slandering Islam is a politically motivated act that cannot be chalked up to freedom of speech.
It's much beyond so-called freedom of speech slogans in Western countries, European countries. It is what I can observe very clearly, and anyone who's following the events and recent attacks and insults against Quran, Islamic sanctities, Holy Prophet of Islam, religious figures in different European countries can evidently find the political agendas behind these events. It's very clear what took place in Sweden, for example, Stockholm, Sweden. It was in front of the Turkish embassy, sending a very clear message to the Turkish government, Turkish nation. Weeks before that, we observed the, Charlie Hebdo in France that announced a cartoon contest, trying to mock the Iranian supreme leader, who is a religious leader also for tens of millions of the Shia Muslims across the globe. And the recent events, again, burning Quran, These are all, I believe, not about so-called freedom of speech from one side and believing in sanctities, Islamic and religious sanctities on the other side. That's not the case. This is what typically we are facing, that from one side, European values, Western values, who believe in freedom of speech, and on the other side, Muslims who don't want their sanctities being touched or discussed or criticized. That is not the case. I believe a political agenda is behind that. There is nothing as, pure freedom of speech, liberal life. No, that's not at all.
The Israeli regime is clamping down on Palestinians in several cities across the occupied West Bank. The Palestinians are angry over the regime's deadly raid into the Jenin refugee camp, in which dozens of their compatriots were killed or injured. The Palestinian Red Crescent says 54 people have been injured in the town of Beita, south of Nablus. It said the injuries were caused by tear gas and rubber bullets. Israeli forces also targeted Palestinians in the town of Al-Ram, north of Al-Quds, following the funeral of a man killed by Israeli forces yesterday. Similar attacks have been reported in Beit Omar, Beit Dajan, and Kafr Gadum. Meanwhile, thousands of Palestinians also held a demonstration near the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds to denounce the regime's attack on the Jenin refugee camp. That was one of the deadliest raids in years, leaving 9 Palestinians dead and many more injured. Another Palestinian was killed by Israeli fire in Al-Ram, bringing to 30 the number of Palestinians killed in the West Bank by Israeli forces this year.
Thousands of people have taken part in the funeral procession of Palestinians killed in the Israeli forces raid on the West Bank city of Jenin Thursday. Carrying the martyrs' bodies, the mourners chanted slogans condemning the Israeli crimes. It was early Thursday when Palestinian media reported the regime forces raid on the Jenin refugee camp. The savage attack left the residents and popular resistance groups based in the camp with no choice but to defend themselves and confront the regime forces.
What happened today in Jenin governorate is a massacre in the very sense of the word. We received 8 martyrs and 1 martyr in Ibn Sina Hospital. In addition to 18 wounded, 3 of them are in a very serious condition. Most of the injuries were due to direct targeting with the aim of killing.
Later in the day, the Israeli troops fatally shot another Palestinian in the town of Al-Ram, near the occupied city of Al-Quds. The Palestinian was killed during a protest against the Israeli forces' raid on Jenin. With a total death toll of 10, January 26th turned into one of the deadliest days in the occupied West Bank since Israel's military raids intensified at the start of last year. Iran's foreign ministry reacted to the bloody incident. It called on Muslim countries to unite and coordinate their actions in support of the oppressed Palestinian nation and the resistance to stop the apartheid regime's acts of terror. Palestinian resistance groups have also condemned the Israeli atrocity in the strongest words, calling for continued resistance against the regime.
The massacre that the Israeli occupation army committed in Jenin confirms the racist, fascist, and criminal nature of the right-wing occupation government. This aggression, in addition to the continued violations at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and of the rights of the Palestinians in Israel, shows that this government insists on escalating the situation.
Our resistance will carry on and shall not back off from confronting this Zionist occupier, and the killing will not intimidate us and will not be intimidated by these threats made by the criminal leaders of this Zionist entity.
Palestinian resistance movements say the latest Israeli raid on Jenin comes within the context of recent escalations, especially in light of the new far-right cabinet headed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist allies. Hamas and Islamic Jihad have both expressed readiness to fight back in case these raids continue. Analysts believe that Palestinians need to bolster resistance against Israel to neutralize the regime's vicious plots.
The resistance should continue and should be escalated against the Israeli, and they should know that they should pay the price for all crimes they are committing.
Actually, they mean to eliminate the resistance in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, to pave the way to construct more Israeli settlements in the West Bank, in which we all know that these settlements are internationally illegal.
Jenin is among those areas in the northern West Bank where Israel intensified its raids over the past year in an attempt to crack down on the Palestinian resistance. In addition to Palestinian resistance fighters, civilians confronting the Israeli army during such raids and even bystanders have been killed mercilessly. More than 170 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, were killed across the occupied West Bank last year. Moreover, at least 29 Palestinians, including 5 children, have been killed in January 2023 alone.
Also, Israeli aircraft have once again carried out airstrikes against the besieged Gaza Strip as tensions escalate following the deadly Israeli raid in Jenin. The Israeli regime says its strike targeted an underground rocket manufacturing site and military base run by the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas. There are no reports of casualties yet. The strikes came hours after Palestinians fired 2 rockets at Israeli positions. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility for rockets fired from Gaza, saying that they were part of a message to show Palestinian blood is not cheap. Hamas hailed the rocket attack, saying Palestinians have the right to fight the Israeli aggression. The Israeli massacre of Palestinians in Jenin has prompted outrage across the world, including in the Jordanian capital Amman. People there have taken to the streets to condemn Israeli crimes. The protesters chanted slogans against the Israeli regime and voiced support for Palestinians. They also slammed the normalization deals with the Israeli regime. In 1994, Jordan signed a peace treaty with Israel to become only the second Arab country to normalize relations with the regime after Egypt. Four other Arab countries, including the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, normalized relations with Israel in 2020 under U.S.-backed deals and amid condemnation by Muslims worldwide. French protesters have held a torchlight march in the capital, Paris, against a controversial pension reform that would increase the retirement age from 62 to 64. This is the latest in a series of protests and strikes that have rocked France in recent weeks. Despite the public discontent, President Emmanuel Macron's government went ahead with the plan, presenting it at a cabinet meeting on Monday. The plan still needs to go through Parliament. Macron's government says raising the retirement age aims to balance the system's books. The opposition rejects that, accusing Macron of trying to stamp his authority on the country. Trade unions plan to step up their protests until the reform plan is dropped. A strike is scheduled for next Tuesday. And Russia has dismissed new U.S. sanctions against Moscow over the war in Ukraine, calling them absurd. The Russian embassy in the United States says foreign companies are the first to suffer from the measures. That's because the embassy says the ability of those companies to do business with Russia is constantly shrinking. The new sanctions announced on Thursday target dozens of people and entities. They include Russian private company Wagner Group, which is fighting in Ukraine, and the latest development of the conflict there. The Ukrainian military has said the danger of Russian air attacks remains high. On Friday, a day earlier, Russian airstrikes killed 11 people in different locations. Kiev said its forces had repelled some of the Thursday strikes. And the UK and Canada say that they will send heavy tanks to Ukraine following similar decisions by the United States and Germany. The British government says it will send 14 Challenger 2 tanks by the end of March. It added that training of Ukrainian soldiers in how to use and maintain those tanks will start next week. Canada, for its part, said it will supply heavy tanks to Ukraine, starting with a shipment of 4 fully operational German Leopards. The new development came after Germany promised to provide Ukraine with its Leopard tanks by the end of March. Following Berlin's announcement, the U.S. said it would send 31 Abrams tanks to bolster Ukraine in its war with Russia.
The confrontation between Russia and the West is getting more complicated after Germany and the United States announced their decisions to send advanced tanks to Kiev. The U.S. is sending 31 Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine. Biden told reporters at the White House that the tanks highlight America's enduring commitments to Ukraine.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
The reversal of the U.S.'s previous position came after Germany said it will send 14 of its Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. Berlin has also given permission to partner countries to re-export other battle tanks to Kiev. Biden has praised the decision by Germany and stressed on what he called Western unity against Russia. Germany was reluctant to send tanks to Ukraine and was waiting for the U.S. to take the front lead. Britain had earlier announced that it would give Ukraine its Challenger tanks. While Berlin was concerned about escalating the war, Washington cited logistical and maintenance challenges. Western nations had so far refused to give heavy armored vehicles to Ukraine. Kiev is now pushing its Western allies to deliver fourth-generation fighter jets, such as the American F-16. But the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says there is no chance of any fighter jets being sent to Ukraine, despite renewed calls for high-end aircraft. Ukraine's Air Force has a fleet of aging Soviet-era fighter jets. Western military support has been vital for Kiev.
I follow the debate closely surrounding these tanks. You know, you do have a number of German officials and experts, commentators saying we can't have German tanks, you know, on the border with Russia again. This evokes terrible memories of World War II. But the counter argument to this is, because you hear a lot about Russia, is if you look at how Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union, it invaded it through Ukraine and Belarus. So Germany also has a historic responsibility.
Russia slammed the decision to transfer the advanced tanks to Ukraine as a blatant provocation. Moscow says the move is extremely dangerous and will escalate the conflict. The U.S. has provided billions of dollars in military aid to Ukraine since the war began in February last year.
By announcing his decision to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine, Germany is now actively involved in the war with Russia. The German foreign minister has said that Germany and its allies are, quote, fighting a war against Russia. Comments have been described as rare and frank remarks about the Western role in the conflict. Sergei Nechayev, Russia's ambassador to Germany, said this extremely dangerous decision takes the conflict to a new level of confrontation and contradicts the statements of German politicians about Germany's unwillingness to get involved in it. Russia has harshly criticized the decision by NATO members to send heavy weaponry to Ukraine as a blatant provocation. The Kremlin has said that any Abrams battle tanks supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. would, quote, burn. Russian officials have dismissed the expected delivery as an expensive folly.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
Uncertainty and fractures among the lords of transnational capital were on display at the World Economic Forum in Davos. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, the transnational corporate and political elite were back in Davos, Switzerland from January 16th to 20th for their annual conclave amid the most severe crisis of global capitalism since the founding of the World Economic Forum half a century ago. In earlier years, participants in the exclusive gathering jet-setted into the Swiss resort town, exuding confidence in the hegemony of global capitalism. But this time around, uncertainty over their ability to manage the crisis, maintain control, restabilize global capitalism, and rebuild fractured consensus in their ranks was on full display. The World Economic Forum served as a premier clearinghouse and planning body of the transnational capitalist class and its political allies during the heyday of capitalist globalization. But now, the ruling groups appear to be in permanent crisis management. The Davos elite are actually aware that global capitalism faces a series of interlinked crises. What the World Economic Forum's annual Global Risks Report for 2023 termed as polycrisis. The world is facing inflation, cost of living crises, trade wars, capital outflows from emerging markets, widespread social unrest, geopolitical confrontation and specter of nuclear war, warned the recent report. These risks are amplified by comparatively new developments in the global risk landscape, including unsustainable levels of debt, a new era of low growth, low global investment, and deglobalization, a decline in human development after decades of progress, rapid and unconstrained development of dual use, civilian and military technologies, and the growing pressure of climate change impacts. Together, these are converging to shape a unique, uncertain, and turbulent decade to come, the report concluded. Under the aegis of World Economic Forum, IMF, other international financial institutions, and key Western governments led by the U.S., the transnational capitalist class has pushed a brutal capitalist organization since 1980s. In the process, destabilizing and throwing into insecurity countless communities, whole countries and regions. This globalization has resulted in an unprecedented concentration and centralization of capital on a global scale in the hands of transnational capitalist class. In 2018, just 17 global financial conglomerates collectively managed $41.1 trillion, more than half the GDP of the entire planet. At the same time, globalization has unleashed unprecedented inequalities and triggered social and political conflict around the world. Rising inequality, impoverishment, and insecurity for working and popular classes after decades of social decay wrought by neoliberalism are throwing states into crises of legitimacy, destabilizing national political systems, and jeopardizing elite control. Just days before the Davos meeting opened, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace updated its global protest tracker, reporting that over 400 major anti-government protests have erupted worldwide since 2017, a quarter of them sustained 3 months or more, many of them involving hundreds of thousands and even millions of protesters, and no less than 32 of them still ongoing as the conclave got underway. As if to symbolize the spreading global revolts, on day three of the meeting, more than a million people took to the streets in nearby Paris to protest attacks on pensions and other neoliberal policies, while just across the English Channel, UK, workers pushed forward with a wave of strikes not seen in decades. Not surprisingly, both French President Emmanuel Macron and UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak skipped Davos this year in order to tend to crises at home. Global capitalism faces a structural crisis of over-accumulation and chronic stagnation. The transnational capitalist class has accumulated obscene amounts of wealth, well above what it can reinvest. But the ruling groups also face a political crisis of state legitimacy, capitalist hegemony, and widespread social disintegration, an international crisis of geopolitical confrontations, and an ecological crisis of epochal proportions. The planetary ecosystem on which human civilization is based is breaking down under the impact of unrestrained global capital accumulation. As background context, a 2021 U.S. government intelligence report warned that the world will face more intense and cascading global challenges in the coming years, including climate change, disease, financial crises, and technology disruptions that are likely to manifest more frequently and intensely in almost every region and country, and that produce widespread strains on states and societies, as well as shocks that could be catastrophic. The report went on to note that the scale of transnational challenges and the emerging implications of fragmentation are exceeding the capacity of existing systems and structures. The COVID-19 pandemic was supposed to have paved the way for resetting and reshaping the world in what the World Economic Forum termed the Great Reset. This was a euphemism for an effort to restabilize and expand global capitalism through more neoliberal deregulation, the application of new digital technologies, a more regimented and authoritarian control over the global population, surveillance, and technocratic global governance, but things have not gone as anticipated. Instead, the pandemic accelerated all the contradictions and crisis tendencies of global capitalism, especially the tendency toward an ever greater concentration of wealth and power in the hands of transnational capitalist class, which has further fueled mass protests and political instability around the world. Each year, the International Development Agency Oxfam times the release of its annual report on global inequalities to coincide with the Davos meeting. According to this year's report, survival of the richest billionaire fortunes are increasing by $2.7 billion a day, even as 1.7 billion or more workers now live in countries where inflation is outpacing wages, and the richest 1% of humanity grabbed for itself nearly two-thirds of all new wealth created since 2020. In the midst of a global food and energy crisis, the top 95 food and energy corporations more than doubled their profits in 2022, according to the report, making $306 billion in windfall profits and paying out $257 billion of debt to rich shareholders, at the same time as nearly 1 billion people went hungry. Meanwhile, Oxfam report warned that three-quarters of the world's governments are planning austerity-driven public sector spending cuts, including healthcare and education, by a whopping $7.8 trillion over the next 5 years. Geopolitical fragmentation and confrontation are reaching a breaking point. The United States is losing its dominant position in the international system, but no new nation-state power has the political authority necessary to take leadership of the now inextricably integrated global economy. The crisis of hegemony in the international system takes place within this single integrated global economy. The end of U.S.-European domination of world capitalism is upon people as the center of gravity of the global economy shifts to other countries. Rather, the world is moving toward political multipolarity at a time of acute crisis in global capitalism, prolonged economic turbulence, and political decay. We are facing nothing short of the decay of capitalist civilization. The Davos elites are aware of the severity of the global crisis, that the system is cracking up, that their grip on power is more and more tenuous and dependent on a global police state, and that the global working and popular classes are on the move. But the World Economic Forum's commitment to defend and expand at all costs the endless accumulation of capital on a world scale, this is its raison d'être, makes it impossible for the global ruling class to offer viable solutions to the epochal crisis. Addressing this crisis involves a far-reaching redistribution of wealth and power downward, the regulation of global markets, reining in transnational capital, the demilitarization of global society, and radical environmental measures. Such solutions will only come from massive struggle from below against the Davis ruling class.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Rajab being the beginning of the spiritual season in the Islamic calendar, where we see that when it comes to the rituals, ibadat, fasting, and dua, they play a very important role as far as the spiritual season is concerned. And this is where I would like to, you know, take this opportunity to discuss a very important dua which we recite after every namaz in the month of Rajab. It is a dua which has come from us, from Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. Which was, in a way, dictated by the Imam on the request of Muhammad bin Zakwan, who is known as As-Sajjad, and which is a very, very famous dua. I thought I would spend some time tonight to talk about this dua and the importance of it as far as the meaning is concerned, so that we can learn and understand what we are saying. You can divide the dua of this dua of the month of Rajab into two parts. One part has four nida and one dua. And the second part has three nida and one dua. Now what is nida? Nida basically is this act of calling someone. The very first one, يَا مَنْ أَرْجُوهُ لِكُلِّ خَيْرٍ وَآمَنُوا سَخَطُهُ إِنْدَ كُلِّ شَرٍ. That all the one, أَرْجُوهُ لِكُلِّ خَيْرٍ, from whom we hope and expect every good. وَآمَنُوا سَخَطُهُ إِنْدَ كُلِّ شَرٍ. And in every situation of evil, we seek protection from his anger. And this is where when we talk about dua, you know, it's very important to keep this concept of Raja. Ya man arjuhu likulli khair. You should have belief in Allah. If you are not sure and then you are doing dua, it's not going to be acceptable. And this is where you have to have this trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And according to the hadith that we have from Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, he says, when you do dua, do the dua with your heart, with this conviction that Allah can help you in what you want. He says, have that hope in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as if when you are doing the dua, your wish is already being delivered at the doors of your house. If you have that kind of yaqeen, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, in Surah Baqarah, part of the ayat which came for the month of Ramadan, this is where he says, إِذَا ثَعَلَكَ عِبَادِي عَنِّي. O Muhammad, when my servants ask you about me, where am I? When they say, where is Allah? Respond to them, فَإِنِّي قَرِيبٌ أُجِيبُ دَعْوَةَ الدَّاعِ إِذَا دَعَانِي. Say to them, I'm very close to them. I am close to them than their jugular vein. When they call me, I am there. فَلْيَسْتَجِيبُ But for me to respond to them, I would like to see that whether they have this hope in me or not. Do they trust me or not? Do they have this belief in me or not? Therefore, he says, therefore they should respond to me also. Come with that yaqeen. وَيُؤْمِنُ بِي And have faith in me. لَعَلَّهُمْ يَرْشُدُونَ This is how, you know, they perhaps they will be rightly guided. And so this is the first nida where we are being taught by the sixth imam that the issue of raja is very important. Keep that in mind that you are addressing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from the angle of hope that you have in His mercy and khair. Then we come to the second nida. Ya man yu'ti al-kathir bil-qaleel. O the one who gives immensely, plentiful, in return for the little that we do. Again, this is where we are appealing to the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that when it comes to our deeds and the way you reward us, it is not equal. And it's a standard, you know, measure that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in surah number 6, ayat number 160, he says very clearly, وَمَنْ جَاءَ بِالْحَسَنَةِ فَلَهُ عَشْرُ أَمْثَالِهَا Whoever comes to me with a good deed, I am going to reward him 10 times. So we shouldn't be sitting there thinking that, you know, I have done quite a lot and therefore what I have got, this is what I deserve. No, actually, you don't deserve that much. For every one good deed, you are actually being rewarded 10 times. And on the flip side, he says, وَمَنْ جَاءَ بِسَيِّئَةً Whoever comes with a sin, فَلَا يُجْزَ إِلَّا مِثْلُهَا He will not be punished but according to one to one. So this is where we see the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is there right from the very beginning. And so we are appealing to His grace and His lutf by saying, يَا مَنْ يُعْتِ الْكَثِيرِ بِالْقَلِيلِ O the one who is giving quite a lot, plentiful, in return for the little that we do. And then the third nida, Ya man yu'ti man sa'ala. The first one was kind of reward for what we do. And he gives us more than what we deserve. The third one here is, Ya man yu'ti man sa'ala. All the one who gives those who ask and you know, pray to him and do dua. The fourth Nida. We are still talking to Allah, you know, calling Him. The dua has not yet come. The fourth nida, Ya man yu'ti man lam yas'aluhu wa man lam ya'rifuhu tahannunan minhu wa rahma. A very powerful and beautiful statement. You know, we have to appreciate the greatness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now we are appealing to that universal mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that all the one. You see, in the second nida, we were talking about the one who gives in return for the good deeds, but he gives more than what we deserve. In the third nida, Ya man yu'ti man sa'ala, he gives to those who are asking. In the fourth nida, we are saying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, all the one. Who gives to those who never even ask, not even that they don't ask, وَلَمْ يَعْرِفُهُ Doesn't even know him. Doesn't even recognize him. Doesn't even acknowledge his presence. A kafir, and mulhid, an atheist. تَحَنُّنًا مِنْهُ وَرَحْمَةً And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala even blesses them out of His grace and His mercy.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
Britain's electricity generators have been forced to warm up, polluting coal-fired power stations for the second time this winter after a sustained period of cold weather and lower wind generation. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. British households will be paid to cut their electricity use for the first time on Monday, 23rd of January, between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m, under plans being drawn up by the National Grid. As temperatures plummet to minus 2 degrees Celsius, ramping up pressure on Britain's supplies, the power network operator is planning to call on consumers to use less electricity to help it manage the system. Around 1 million people have signed up to the scheme, which will see them paid as much as £10 a day to cut the amount of electricity they use at certain times as part of efforts to tackle the energy crisis. This could mean, for example, not running the washing machine or the dishwasher during 5 to 6 p.m., or waiting to charge an electric car until nighttime. The scheme has previously been trialled, but proposals to use it at a time of high demand have never reached this stage of planning before. Energy sources last night said agreements linked to the plans had been made with suppliers that could not be reneged upon. In a further sign of strain on Britain's energy supply, the National Grid has also asked extra coal-fired power plants to be ready to supply backup electricity on Monday evening, 23rd of January, if needed. National Grid's Electricity System Operator, ESO, said it was activating the programme, known as Demand Flexibility Service, between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. on Monday, 23rd of January. A spokesman said, "Our forecasts show electricity supply margins are expected to be tighter than normal on Monday evening. This does not mean electricity supplies are at risk and people should not be worried. These are precautionary measures to maintain the buffer of spare capacity that we need." The National Grid introduced the Demand Flexibility Service last year amid concern over power supplies this winter due to disruption to gas markets caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict, as well as outages on France's nuclear fleet. Aging nuclear power plants in Britain have also shut down. Meanwhile, more of Britain's electricity is also coming from wind power and from solar energy, which are intermittent, making the system more complex to run. The measures come as the Met Office has issued a weather warning about freezing fog on Monday, 23rd of January. A level 3 cold alert will remain in place for England until Wednesday, 25th of January, after temperatures plunged below minus 10 degrees Celsius in parts of Britain last week. Temperatures are expected to drop as low as minus 2 degrees Celsius on Monday, 23rd of January, with very little wind, meaning there will be limited electricity from wind power and higher demand from British households. National Grid has run several tests of the demand flexibility scheme this winter, but has not so far needed to use it outside of testing. The closest it has so far come to doing so was on 28th of November last year, when it issued a notice to the market saying it might be needed, but ultimately decided that it was not. Technically, it is possible for the call to cut supplies on Monday evening to yet be called off. However, it is understood National Grid agreed payments on Sunday with suppliers to do so, meaning that this is very unlikely. A source said it will be the first live event for the demand flexibility scheme. Bids have been accepted from the energy suppliers and prices agreed upon, and that can't be reneged upon. It is locked in for, and it will be for the first time it will be used for real. Under the scheme, Britain's households who have signed up will be notified by their supplier that they can be paid to cut usage of electricity between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. on Monday, 23rd of January, and how much they will be paid to do so. They do not have to opt in. How much households can earn will depend on their supplier and how much power they would normally use, but some could earn around £10 per session, for example. During testing, suppliers have been paid £3 per kilowatt hour saved, but they are likely to get more outside of testing. Some are understood to have agreed on £6 per kilowatt hour for Monday evening, 23rd of January. They can choose whether to pass on the full amount to their customers or even pay more. Suppliers who have signed up to the Demand Flexibility Service scheme include Octopus Energy and British Gas. It is open to households in Britain with a second-generation smart meter. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Britain's electricity generators have been forced to warm up coal-fired power stations for the second time this winter after a sustained period of cold weather and lower wind generation. With a high-pressure weather system with associated light winds likely to dominate for a few more days, National Grid's Electricity System Operator, or ESO, said early on Sunday, 22nd of January, it had asked Drax to start warming two of its coal units at its North Yorkshire site and EDF to do the same for one of its West Burton plant in Nottinghamshire to ensure supplies on Monday, 23rd of January. The ESO, the electricity system operator, added that it was also activating its live demand flexibility service between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. on Monday, 23rd of January. Selected customers will be financially incentivized to cut their electricity consumption between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. The request over the power plant followed a similar one in the middle of December, although back then the coal-fired stations were not used, as the operator generated enough power from other sources. Our forecasts show electricity supply margins are expected to be tighter than normal on Monday evening, 23rd of January. The electricity system operator ESO said, "We have instructed coal-fired power units to be available to increase electricity supplies should it be needed. This does not mean electricity supplies are at risk and people should not be worried. These are precautionary measures to maintain the buffer of spare capacity that we need." Last summer, amid a peak in gas prices caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the electricity system operator ESO negotiated a winter contingency contract with a number of coal generators at the request from the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. Overall, this is likely to be a challenging winter for energy supply throughout Europe. "We have taken extensive measures to try to mitigate the impact for British consumers and expect that, under our base case, margins will be adequate, ESO said at the time. Normally, there is enough electricity power generation by onshore and offshore wind turbines. However, electricity system operators said it had taken the precautionary step to ensure the lights stay on as the country gets back to work on Monday, 23rd of January. With much of the United Kingdom enjoying light winds and a cold sunny day on Sunday, 22nd of January, wind power accounted for just 6.8 gigawatts of electricity, about 17.6% of the total electricity being generated on that day. 2 weeks ago, on 10th of January, British wind farms were producing three times as much electrical power, averaging 21.6 gigawatts of electricity and setting a new record. In spite of Sunday's move to prepare coal-fired units for generation, data shows that Britain's generation is becoming greener. More than 50% of the country's electricity came from zero-carbon sources in December, and another record was achieved on 30th of December, with a peak of 87.2% of electricity coming from zero-carbon sources in one day.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. Pairing is a universal law in the world of creation. This pairing exists in plants and animals as well, but this fixed law has certain criteria for human beings. They have set certain rules for human beings in particular. Why have they set these rules? Because pairing could have occurred without rules, in the same way that irregularities exist in some parts of the world. The reason for this is that human beings do things by their own choice. A person's movement and progress is not possible without his own decision and free will. This decision and authority must be in a particular framework. Otherwise, one person may choose something and another person may choose something that is the opposite. And this will result in chaos.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We need laws in order to establish order in society, in history, and in the life of human beings. There are laws everywhere. They also exist in a matter of human beings pairing. Again, this is not limited to Islam. If you look at all the religions in the world, pairing takes place based on a law. In Christianity, in Judaism, even in Buddhism, and in other places, in other religions, as far as I know, there is a law by which a man and woman become a couple. Lawlessness in this area is a sin. It is a crime. It is cruel, and it creates disorder and chaos. These rules are good for the well-being of a family. If these criteria are adhered to, this will result in healthy families. When families become healthy, society will become healthy. Families are the cells that make up society. When families become healthy, society becomes healthy. So, what is a woman's role in the family environment? From what I have gathered from the collection of information that is available in the verses of the Holy Quran, in narrations and the like, what I picture in my mind is that a woman is the air that fills the atmosphere in a family. That is, just as you would not be able to breathe if there was no air in the environment, that is how it would be if there was no woman in your family environment.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.